WLFP Braddock.
Good morning to listeners everywhere, wherever you are. I got you that one, didn't I?
Yeah. I don't think you were quite ready to begin there.
I was. I just wanted to have a different intro.
There you go. This is Peter, just think, since you didn't say welcome, Peter. I am.
I didn't even have a chance to say that.
And we have guests in the studio, and we have a guest somewhere lost in space we're expecting to have call, and people coming in just all the time. It's going to be a fascinating show.
It's called Seat of Your Pants Show.
And I'm not going to be able to get a word in edgeways because I'm surrounded here in the studio.
Yeah, we have, by the way, just in case you're wondering, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And in the studio, which is quite crowded, we have two guests today. We have Mindy Schwartz of Garden Dreams. And we have Virginia Phillips, who is the local coordinator for our Slow Food Convivium in Pittsburgh, and she's also a general expert in all things farming. Uh-huh. Not really. She's shaking her head.
So say good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Hi.
So we're waiting to hear from Patricia Wells, but she's trying to call from France. And her new book is Vegetable Harvest, which you can find on our website, www.onthemenuradio.com. Check out on OTM Bookshelf, and you can order right off there.
There you go.
Yeah. Now, Mindy supplies us with all of our... First of all, tell us about Garden Dreams. It's an urban farm, and I mean urban.
Right. It's located in the heart of Wilkinsburg. And Wilkinsburg is a very urban area just east of the city limits of Pittsburgh. And it had a couple dilapidated houses on it, two vacant lots right now, on its way to becoming five vacant lots at some point in the future. And the houses got torn down, and I started growing food and started growing more and more food and eventually grew enough food that I couldn't give it away, so I had to start selling it. One thing led to another, and so now I grow heirloom tomatoes and peppers and eggplants as well as food.
Herbs,
too, right?
And you're going to start raising chickens, you said?
Well, I have my whole next vision, my next evolution beyond urban farming, which is urban homesteading. So I'm on my way to building Hamnet Homestead Sustainable Living Center. And instead of growing like 45 feet of basil, which you can sell for a pretty good price to chefs, I will grow maybe 10 feet of basil for myself and my family and my friends and my neighbors, and maybe 20 feet of chickens and 10 feet of honey. So it's a whole different model. And just yesterday I was checking out langostinos in a pond on a farm out near Aliquippa, out near Blairsville, and to see as a possible protein source in a pond I want to build on the homestead.
Virginia, you're really deeply involved with growing and the whole slow food movement and local. And I mean, all those words now, they're all sort of splurting out, local, sustainable, organic, blah, blah, and so forth. I don't know. Do you have a different explanation of it?
Well, just a little. I think I would agree with almost everything except the growing part. Let's put the emphasis on eating.
Uh-huh.
And really, the emphasis is more on creating some connections between local eaters and local growers, which until recent years haven't been so close and easy, and they're just getting better and better, and we're promoting all these great local growers and producers of local protein and wonderful stuff.
Yeah,
that's our job.
And Virginia is a really beautiful food writer, and you've done so much to advance the slow food movement and to represent our area, which is very, very importantly and deeply involved, right, in this slow food movement.
It is, in fact.
It's right at the top there, isn't it?
Well, in slow food, it certainly is. Pittsburgh doesn't have a very large population base, but we do rank about 11th in the whole country. So we're very proud of that and many, many exciting projects, including what we can do for our local growers and this opportunity to participate in the 2007 Farm Food Bill. So I know we're getting to that later.
We're going to get that later. We're going to have to discuss that. And do you grow? I mean, do you, yourself?
I grow a lot of chives and a lot of herbs. Things that cooperate with me, I grow.
Yeah, we grow a lot of chives too. We can't seem to get them to go away. We also grow lots of sorrel, which we can't get to
too.
Go away.
Yeah, what do you do with sorrel?
We grow enough sage to make sage-flavored pork chops for half the population of the planet.
And I hope you don't have lemon balm, because that is really by lemon balm.
Well, we don't have it yet, but we'll probably get it. And then we have all these wonderful salad makings, which I call sticks.
Yeah,
so twigs and sticks. So we have stick salad and twig salad. I bet Jack likes twig salad, too.
He does.
The
only thing he hates more than stick salad is tofu. We'll never get him converted.
Yeah, well, I christened it stick salad. And
it's wild arugula.
Wonderful. And there's all the other funny things you put in it, too.
Right.
But I really have grown to love stick salad.
Attaboy.
Well, you know, this stuff you pay big bucks for. And what's that other stuff that you won't eat?
Purslane.
Purslane. Yeah, that's right between the blocks and the sidewalk.
I actually bought some of the gourmet variety, except it hasn't come up, so I guess I didn't do it right.
That's no question. That's a genuine weed.
You'll plant it in the sidewalk and it'll grow.
Okay.
It'll be much happier there.
Well, this stuff goes in all the wrong places.
Now, one of the things we wanted Mindy to talk to us about is every time you turn around, you're presented with an heirloom tomato salad. Mm. And heirloom tomatoes seem to be right at the top of the heap for what we're looking for. Tell us, how many varieties are there?
Oh, I would imagine, I know for sure there's hundreds. There probably are thousands of varieties from all over the world. Every region has its own specialties.
How did we manage to keep as many as we have since we've had, you know, over the years? I mean, have people just persisted in just keeping their own seeds?
I think that's the key thing, seed saving. And we have organizations like the Seed Savers Exchange and other organizations that promote seed saving, which is crucially important for our entire food system and for the health of the planet in terms of preserving genetic diversity in the crop.
Well, now, how does this say you have an heirloom tomato, how does it not get cross-pollinated? Because I remember my mother used to have to get new seeds every year for Polish tomatoes.
Were they hybrids?
They were kind of pink. They were smuggled in from Poland by her hairdresser.
The statute of limitations is long gone by, so yes. you're okay.
But they would get contaminated by cross-pollinization.
Well, I think that if you want to save your seeds for certain varieties of tomatoes, for open pollinated or heirloom varieties of tomatoes, it's safest to plant them a certain distance apart from other tomatoes so that they don't cross-pollinate. Most things won't cross-pollinate, and they do come back true to form. But if you plant a hybrid, then it comes back. It doesn't come back true. It comes back as one of the parents or some combination thereof.
You know so much about this.
Yeah,
How many years have you been doing this?
We don't know where the Polish tomato seeds really came from.
Poland.
I mean, we know they came from Poland, but we don't know, you know, how carefully they were collected.
Well, I know that we had to have new ones, and they were pink. They're really very good.
And all I want to know is, do you still have any?
No.
Who's that hairdresser?
I'm interested in the romance. You have a whole bunch of information on the romance of these heirloom tomatoes. Virginia, just jump in whenever you feel like it.
Okay, thanks.
Well, I think that the romance of heirloom tomatoes speaks to a large degree to our awakening awareness of food issues in our country and the world. I think that agriculture it's a system that has gotten more and more complicated as time has gone on, maybe over the last 50, 60, 100 years. And we think that at times we think it's best for systems to get more complicated, and we produce tomatoes, and we produce tomatoes that our whole priorities have changed. So we produce tomatoes on a large-scale business where they're red, they're really red, and they're really round, and they ship really well. But they don't taste very good. And we are discovering, as our awareness is increasing about the importance of the food we eat and the connection to our health and the connection to our environment, how we as healthy people need a healthy environment, and how there's all this culture associated with food, we are yearning for these old varieties of tomatoes that we used to eat a long time ago.
So you think it's nostalgia?
Yes, it's nostalgia.
But I think they taste better.
It's nostalgia and it's awareness and it's taste. Of course, it's all driven by taste.
Well, who grew black tomatoes? They're incredible.
Right. Well, a lot of black tomatoes have come from Russia, around the Caspian Sea, Czechoslovakia. I mean, all over. There's a number of black tomatoes. Black Crème, Cherokee Purple, Black Seaman, Black from Tula, Purple Calabash.
They're sweet, I think.
Well, and a little bit salty.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see.
Some of them.
And then how about the Brandywine? I can remember individual tomatoes just coming into my life, like going out to see Rick Contre at the farm market in Mount Lebanon. He said, "You got to see these, Virginia. I've got these Brandywines. They're as big as boxing gloves and twice as ugly, and wait till you taste these things."
Uh-huh.
And were they good? And then Sungolds. Sungolds were such a revelation to me.
Yeah, I love Sungolds.
And Deborah Madison's soup that you make with those things. Oh, my goodness gracious. Then going out to Berkeley, maybe 10 years ago now, I think, and seeing, remember 10 years ago in Pittsburgh what we didn't have, 50 heirloom tomatoes in this line stretching as far as the eye could see. And in between, they had this little place where you could have a massage. You just lie down on a mattress and have a massage while you're trying to lessen your stress of which heirloom tomato you would choose.
That's
true.
Really hysterical.
It's a marketing run riot.
Hope it comes here.
Well, no, like, where do some of these other tomatoes come from? Like, where, like the Green Zebra has become very popular.
Well, I'm not sure where Green Zebra is very popular. It's sweet, tangy, but I'm not sure where. I've never learned where Green Zebra comes from.
Well, listen, think about where it comes from, and we're going to take a break.
T1 Internet access wasn't affordable to many companies as little as 2 years ago. Service providers were charging in the thousands of dollars, keeping the benefits of a T1 connection out of most companies' reach. ASP Station is now offering the faster and more reliable T1 service at a price significantly less than 2 years ago. The speed of a T1 for both sending and receiving data is simply amazing and will change the way your business runs indefinitely. You'll wonder how you ever lived without it. Call ASP Station now for details. 412-661-6001. 412-661-6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go fast.
Call ASP Station now for details. 412-661-6001. That's 412-661-6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go, fast.
Hi, everyone. This is Tom Rita, the networking guy and host of Pittsburgh's most unique business show, Business in the Fast Lane. We're on every Saturday morning from 12 noon to 1 p.m. right here on The Edge, 1550 a.m. For the past 24 months, we've been bringing the best and the brightest into our studios to offer you ideas, advice, and real-world examples to help you grow your business. So save those honeydews for the afternoon and join me, Tom Rita, every Saturday morning from 12 to 1 on The Edge for Business in the Fast Lane, Pittsburgh's best kept secret.
Hey, kid, over here, inside your radio. Name's Ralph. I'm an energy hog. Hey, if you're going to waste energy in your home, I'm going to pig out on it. Anyway, I got a deal for you. There's this new website called energyhog.org. Forget about it. It teaches kids how to get rid of us energy hogs. So you promise not to log on to energyhog.org, and I promise not to eat your radio. Deal?
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
EnergyHog.org. Forget.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. In the studio with us, we have Mindy Schwartz of Garden Dreams and Virginia Phillips, food writer and general manager of our local Slow Food Convivium. And we now have on the phone the wonderful Patricia Wells, who's the food critic for the International Herald Tribune and the author of 10 books, Patricia, my goodness. Yes, including all of them wonderful, including one that's a little out of the ordinary for you called Vegetable Harvest.
Oh, it's not out of the ordinary at all. It's right in line with all the way I'm cooking today.
Oh, good. But you now devote more space to vegetables in the center of the plate. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what steered you to do that, just the way you're eating?
I think actually it was just kind of a natural thing. I realized with a garden and with Everyone telling us, eat more vegetables. I just began creating menus that centered around vegetables rather than around the meat and the fish and poultry. And my concept now is to go to the market or go to the garden, find four or five great vegetables in season, work around those, and then add your meat or your poultry or your fish.
Yeah, and we should point out it's not a vegetarian.
No, not at all. I'm not a vegetarian, but I feel that we should just give vegetables a little more due than they've deserved for a lot of, than been given for a lot of years.
Yeah, I think everyone in the studio agrees with you, right?
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, Patricia, you live a life that I think a lot of people would envy, in that you spend about half the year in the wonderful little town of Vaison-la-Romaine.
That's right.
And you can explain perhaps quickly where that is, and then what do you do the rest of the time?
It's near Avignon. Well, when I'm here, I'm usually working with my classes. I do week-long cooking classes here. And I spend much of my time in Paris, where we also have an apartment, and then a lot of time traveling and just, you know, continuing my projects and my work.
And while as you were calling in, we mentioned one of the restaurants in your city that we really love, Le Moulin L'Huile, and I understand the Bardot's, whose names I've forgotten, but they're not Bridget.
No.
are still in
no,
the kitchen.
No, the restaurant's still thriving, still has a Michelin star, and it's a lovely little place right down the hill from
it
us.
It is. Well, you're in a great part of the world, that's for
it
sure.
It is. It's marvelous. It's really great. But I think any place where you can find good vegetables is a good place to be.
Right. Now, your recipes are very interesting. I mean, they always are. But these, you really have devised some unusual ones. It's sort of like you just wiped the slate clean and then came up with some brilliant ideas.
But
well, I think the idea, one of my ideas too is that, and I found when I started working on this book, even after I had the idea, is that like all cooks, I was getting into a rut that, you know, I'd drag out my two favorite eggplant recipes in the summer and then my two favorite zucchinis and put them away and then my one cauliflower recipe and so on. And that we just get in a rut of cooking vegetables in the same way year after year. And I think, you know, you have to realize that almost all vegetables can be eaten raw, braised, grilled, deep-fried, broiled, steamed. They can be cut in very different ways. They can be combined in unusual combinations. And I think that, you know, it just opens up our palate to all sorts of new tastes, flavors, and looks.
You seem to have a lot of fun with this book, too, because you've got wonderful folklore. Like, here's one I'm reading, garlic will make you both brave and courageous, especially if you have it for breakfast.
Right. No, I love doing little, and you know, doing research on anecdotes and folklore, and I think it makes it fun, and also makes you realize that, you know, since Roman and Greek times, they've had little themes about vegetables and fruits, and you know, it makes you realize that they've always been an important part of the diet.
Yeah, you said somewhere I just read that the Romans thought if you planted basil, you had to curse and talk loudly.
Right.
Otherwise it wouldn't thrive, which would suit me just fine in the garden.
And what about the arugula?
Of course, you didn't talking loudly or eating basil.
swearing a lot.
Now, the arugula, we found an answer to why my husband will not eat stick salads. Because when we plant arugula, baby arugula, then, of course,
reverts to sticks.
It reverts to sticks.
I know. Listen, I have the same problem. In fact, my husband once looked up at me in the middle of a meal, and he says, please stop feeding me weeds.
This is Virginia's husband.
What's your husband's name, Patricia?
Walter.
Walter, you have to tell Walter that Peter feels exactly the same way, and so does Jack.
Well, my
Neems.
Favorite story is we were sitting once eating one of our garden salads, and we saw a worm, and then we got into deep discussion. We continued, and we ate the salad, and then we finished it. We looked up, and we said, wonder who got the worm.
Oh, dear. Now, you have other sections here. You have fruity desserts.
Yes. Well, you know, my definition of vegetables is a little, you know, expanded. It's sort of anything that'll grow in my garden. So I did include nuts, and so there's lots of almonds and walnuts and hazelnuts and so on. Because I consider those kind of the vegetables of my garden as well.
And then you have breads.
Breads, of course.
Rosemary scented
whole wheat. With walnuts and figs and dates and so on.
Now let's quickly repeat the
here, this is fresh figs on rosemary skewers. Peter's grabbing this gorgeous
book.
That's delicious. That's really great. You just take you have to have really strong, woody rosemary, but you just thread it with fresh figs and you can kind of roll it in this honey lemon juice mixture and serve it warm with the goat cheese.
What zone are you in? What do you mean, what zone? Well, in the States, you know, like zone four.
I know. Well, I don't think we don't have the equivalents here. I'm at about the 45th parallel, it's actually pretty far north for the U.S. Mm.
You even have the little baby purple artichokes, don't you, Patricia?
I personally don't. I have a three-year rule in my garden. Every vegetable or fruit gets 3 years, and if after 3 years it does nothing, it goes. We've had to give up on artichokes. They just never amount to anything in my garden. Same with peaches. There's some things that just won't grow. I can't grow root vegetables, no matter how much we amend the soil. They end up tasting of struggle, and they say, "I did the best I could with that crappy soil you gave me." But we do great with tomatoes. The things that count for me: tomatoes, lots of herbs, eggplant, zucchini, Swiss chard, and we have a bumper crop of lovely, lovely berries. So I go out and pick about at least a quart of different mixed berries every day, which is just a joy.
Yeah. I remember when we were preparing to go to Provence for the first time, Patricia, we thought there's all this lavender in Provence, so they must use that in cooking. So we started including lavender leaves in recipes that called for rosemary and things like that. And then we discovered that they really don't do that at all.
I don't like using lavender in food. I think lavender is a great perfume, but I don't like perfume in my food.
Let's see who's on the other line, Patricia. Who do we have here?
Dan Imhoff.
Hey, Dan, welcome. That's great. We have Patricia Wells is on the phone. And Patricia, Dan has just written a book called Food Fight about the Farm Act that sort of directs our guiding.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So, but anyhow, we're just finishing up, Dan, with this wonderful book, Patricia Wells's book, Vegetable Harvest.
Okay, great.
I had a question because I don't read quite as many cookbooks as Anna. Patricia, did you have an idea of how people might use the book?
Absolutely. Go to the market and get in the kitchen. That's simple.
So you go to the market, find out what they have fresh in the market, and then you bring it back and look in the index?
Well, hopefully you have an idea. If you're not, you know, if you're anywhere alert, you kind of know what's going to be in season, you know. And my whole feeling is that people should get to know the people who are growing their vegetables, so they'll say, "Will you still have artichokes next week, or do you think you'll have asparagus?" And or save me some because I'll be a little bit late. That's what I do.
Well, what we do, Patricia, not to interrupt you, but for Slow Food Pittsburgh, we send out an advisory every week for our organic
market.
Terrific.
That's great. That's brilliant. And, you know, I think if people, I always go to the market with an idea of what I want, but if it's not there, I know what I can substitute.
Well, Virginia, I'm not Virginia Phillips. Virginia, you do a great job with those, the advisories. They do it also with meat, Patricia.
Oh, that's wonderful.
With local growers. It's really
bravo.
Good.
Yeah.
We've met several restaurateurs recently since we've found more of an emphasis on the farm-to-table kinds of things where the suppliers will bring a box of whatever they have,
and leave it on the
back doorstep on Monday morning.
Well, we have the same thing here with a really great local grower, and he'll every Friday morning you get this wonderful gorgeous box. It's terrific.
Patricia, this has been divine. Maybe we can touch base sometime when you're in the States and have a longer conversation.
Absolutely, it'd be great fun.
And we'll come by and visit you in Provence, which
okay,
we love.
It's a deal.
It's a deal. And anybody wanting to buy this cookbook, just go on our website to OTM Bookshelf. It's www.onthemenuradio.com and click to buy, and it's gone.
Okay.
And I think it's wonderful. I'm so delighted to
great
have
to
it.
Great to chat. Take care.
Thank you, Patricia. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Dan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thank you for... Yeah, we have had a little problem with... Patricia had a power outage as well.
Okay.
And now I'm wondering if we've lost, I'm not sure about...
Dan Barber?
Dan had a power outage at Blue Hill.
Yeah, I got a message that he might be calling in late, so I don't know if you want to reschedule this.
No, we have a full house here.
We can go ahead in the next break. What I'll do is, do we have a contact number for Dan?
Yes, we do.
I'll call him and find out if he's up and going and encourage him to join.
Okay.
Now, you heard who's in the studio.
I don't know.
Okay. It's Dan and Peter Haig, And we also have Mindy Schwartz, who has an urban garden called Garden Dreams. And we have Virginia Phillips, who she's at the forefront of this food fight.
Okay.
And she's a food writer and leads our slow food group. So anyhow, we want to find out, how do we get to this? How come nobody's challenged this before, this wonderful book? And I meant to say that Dan actually wrote this book explaining it. It has a foreword by Michael Pollan, and it's called Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill, which is a slightly different wording instead of just the farm bill, right?
Yes,
and there's a reason for that, and I think there's a reason for this book. Do you want to go ahead and tell us about it?
Sure. You know, what happened to me, kind of the real epiphany moment, was in the summer of 2005, and we just had the transportation and the energy bills passed, and there were these huge government spending bills, and, you know, they really have the power to set things on a good course for a number of years. And I learned about the Farm Bill at that time, and I knew about the good things that the conservation program did, and I knew about the bad things, really, that the commodity supports were really doing and really skewing our food and farming system. But I had no idea of the full impact of the Farm Bill. And yet I became convinced, a number of people convinced me, that the only way that we could change the Farm Bill and use it as an engine for doing good, you know, these tens of billions of dollars that set the whole system in process over 5 years, was if citizens really, you know, realized what they had at stake and they told their representatives they want something very different from what we have. And so I took about a year really just looking at the Farm Bill from a beginner's mind, and I just tried to deconstruct it and break it down into understandable parts, with the single goal, really, of helping people understand that there's a huge amount at stake, and it's really important that we rise up and we close the books on the 20th century farm bills and we get a 21st century food and farm bill.
That's a good thought. Can you hang on while we take a break, and then we'll talk more about the impact of this?
Sure.
Okay, we'll take a break.
Furnace working okay? How's your heating bills? You know, no kidding, an old or inefficient furnace can really add to the cost of keeping your home warm. If you want to keep costs down, get your furnace looked at, and I recommend Bolster to Heart Heating and Air Conditioning for that. The technicians at Bolster to Heart have been performing routine maintenance and installing high-efficiency heating and air conditioning systems in Pittsburgh since 1977. They're EPA-certified professionals who are continually factory-trained in all the latest installation and service techniques. They offer free estimates and don't even charge extra for Saturday service. They're a quality dealer you can trust. Stay warm this winter at the lowest possible cost. Call Bolster to Heart Heating and Air Conditioning at 412-367-3900. Maintenance or installation, Bolster to Heart Heating and Air Conditioning, 412-367-3900.
You're listening to The Edge, AM 1550, WLFP, Braddock, Pittsburgh.
The internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting, Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great. It means no more dial up. Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers. Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
We usually are very cautious with our investment money.
Then we got this email about this great deal on the internet.
They promised us a 75% return on our money in 90 days. We couldn't resist.
That was a mistake.
For information on avoiding investment scams, call the Pennsylvania Securities Commission. 1-800-600-0007.
Sponsored by the Pennsylvania Securities Commission. Edward G. Rendell, Governor.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
Welcome back to On the Menu. We keep gathering a crowd here since last segment. We've added Dan Barber from Blue Hill. We do two restaurants, don't we? We do Blue Hill at Stone Barns and Blue Hill in Manhattan, right, Dan?
That's right.
Yeah, well, we're fans. We've eaten there, too. Dan Imhoff. We're going to get confused with the Dans here. Does anybody want to be called Daniel and we can switch it around?
Nah. Either way, it's fine with me. Or you can call him Dan One.
Who's Dan One? Well, anyhow, what we're here to talk about is the book, Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill. And we're going to be having this bill up for passage. The end of September?
Yeah, September 30th is the deadline.
How long will we be locked into whatever's in that document?
Well, it normally takes sets the rules and the programs and the spending allotments for 5 years. So until 2012, we're stuck with what we come up with.
Okay.
For the most part, it can be changed on a yearly basis, but they're really setting the course and the tone by September 30th.
Well, I asked Virginia to comment on it, and I thought she was very eloquent about her feelings about this book. Virginia, do you want to repeat them on air?
Oh, sure I do. Food bill, farm bill is such a deadening word. It just makes you feel as if you've been chloroformed. And when I saw Dan's book and realized this is an attractive book, it's an appealing book, he has it organized in such a way that you can go into it anywhere and find something fascinating to read. It's just appetizingly paced. It's really fun to read, and it tells you so many things you didn't know. I think he's done the impossible, Dan. I really think you have. Anybody would enjoy it, and it's beautifully designed, too.
Dan, what are the issues we're facing with this food and farm bill?
I'd love it if Dan Barber, I'm a big fan of Dan Barber. I'm so glad he's on this program. I'd love it if Dan started out.
And he's passionate. I've heard him, yes. Go ahead, Dan.
Tell me. I mean, Dan, you should really tell it's your book, and you should really set the tone for both the legislation and the summing up of what it's about.
Okay, then I'll leave you as a chef, eater, take it your stand on it. We're going to have tens of billions, upwards of $80 billion in this farm bill. And it's going to determine what crops we grow on 200 million acres of land and what crops we choose to subsidize over other ones. It's going to basically determine what's cheap in the grocery store and what's not. It's going to determine how we use our land, whether or not we're putting lands aside for conservation, how we're taking care of our watersheds and our soil resources. What kinds of foods ultimately end up on cafeteria trays in schools and also on the trays in food shelters and in over 35 million Americans' homes who have a very limited income. And they need Farm Bill food stamp programs and other nutrition programs just to get by. And then it's going to determine really, you know, the economic fate of family farmers here and communities that are dependent upon subsidies, and they're also struggling in global markets. But it's also going to have effects, ripple effects, on family farmers in other countries, because when we subsidize crops for exports here, we distort the real prices, and then that distorts the world markets, and it can unfairly hurt farmers who may be even more efficient than ours in other countries, who are growing the same commodities that our farmers are and that we're supporting through the Farm Bill.
Right.
Okay, go ahead, Dan Barber.
Well, I would echo that and only say that, you know, the exciting thing and the most promising thing about the Farm Bill is that we get to vote on it. And we get to vote on it sort of by proxy in terms of how we choose to eat. And what Dan does and does so well, and I agree so compellingly, is illustrate, you know, what the power of this bill, of this food and farm bill, and how every eater in this country affects that kind of legislation. They affect that kind of legislation because when they go and buy dinner for their families and their neighbors and friends, they are, you know, casting a vote. They're deciding where they're going to buy their food from and how they're going to pay for it and what kinds of farmers they're buying it from and where the food is coming from and to a large extent how the food is getting to them. All of that is determined in the purchases. And those purchases end up becoming reflected in how our legislators vote for the Farm Bill. And what's happened over the last, you can argue the last 30 or 40 years or 50 years, depending on the way you look at it, but certainly in the last half century, what's happened is everything's changed in all of those things, and how we grow our food and who's growing it and how it's getting to us and the communities that support that kind of farming that we all want. But all of that has changed, and legislatively, you know, what I have been so impressed by both in reading Dan's book and in just studying the issue myself is that it's being guided by a very precise set of rules, and those rules are rules that are written in response to what the marketplace is dictating. And so we're the marketplace, and so what's promising about the Farm Bill and about what Dan has devoted his work to is that we can make changes and we can affect the way the bill is written to reestablish the sort of priorities that we want in our food chain.
Well, but how can we do that effectively, Dan Imhoff, when the people who have written the Farm Bill for the last 30 years are probably people like Archer Daniel?
Yeah, I mean,
how do we as individuals make a difference?
Food and the people that benefit from lots of cheap commodities. Well, you know, every once in a while, there's a wedge that gets driven into this farm policy that came out of the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. And in the 50s, and at a certain point, big ag that you just described, the farm states, the states that are growing just the five commodities, corn, cotton, wheat, rice, and soybeans, they began to really see the Farm Bill as this pot of money that they could use to get the results that they wanted, which was basically cheap ingredients and cheap feeds that could either be made into processed food ingredients or into feeds for livestock in confinement or grains that could be traded around the world. But in the 1960s, a group of legislators concerned about hunger also found the Farm Bill as this pot of money that they could use to get this nutritional safety net that's needed for the hungry. And so for a long time, those two groups, the farm states and the urban legislators concerned about poverty, really dictated the Farm Bill. What we have now is undeniable health evidence that these crops that we're subsidizing are making us really unhealthy. There's
right.
a direct link between the Farm Bill and the obesity crisis. Dan Barber's written about it really well. And they tell us that they're giving us this cheap food system, and it's really anything but cheap because we make the fatty and the sweet foods that are processed really cheap and the healthy foods expensive because we ignore them really through our subsidy programs.
Now, is it reasonable to say then that there ought to be a massive uprising of people who are listening to this program and other people who can be reached with the message in your book, that they need to call their legislators, or what? I mean, does that make any sense? Or?
Oh, Mindy's shaking her head. You know what Dan was saying was let's vote with our forks, let's vote with our dollars, and we also have to vote with our votes. And you know, Food Fight, this is the sixth book that I've done, and I really, you know, I take a pretty advocacy approach toward my projects, and I had one goal, which was really to let's develop some kind of literacy, electoral literacy around this non-sexy but really important issue. And I think if we don't get it in 2007, at least we'll get the beginnings of an understanding that when it comes around again, this is one of the most important things that our representatives vote on. But there's still time. There's still 3 months left, and I'm going to get to do an event with Dan in New York and planning to just keep this message going until the vote, you know, gets done. So I think there's no time like the present to talk to your representative.
I think you make the capital point that the votes are malleable. I mean, there's the red state representatives that are always going to vote, or at least in the foreseeable future, are going to vote for those big subsidy, big ag infrastructure that so defines the farm bill. But look, there are a lot of votes on the floor, and the point, at least the way I've looked at it in the last 30 years, is that there's been a wholesale exchange of votes on issues related to the Farm Bill that constituents, congressional constituents, Senate, people in the Senate, people in the House, view their constituency as uninterested in, right? So when you get into the blue states, let's say, or more urban areas, the overall opinion is that we don't really care that much about something as esoteric as the Farm Bill. And what has happened over the last 20 and 30 years is that the exchange of votes, you know, you
trade off.
Your constituency cares about gun control more, so we're going to trade that for the food vote, because, you know, my constituents don't really care about something like the Farm Bill. Well, that's a big mistake. And what, you know, what I think Dan does so brilliantly and so, appealingly is to make an argument that we're all buying into this and that we need to look at this bill as much more than just something that happens in the Midwest.
I want to take you down a slightly different path, both of you, if I can, for just a second, because a huge controversy recently sprung up between Michael Pollan, who forwarded your book, and also wrote, what was that? What was the book
Omnivore's
called?
Dilemma.
The Omnivore's Dilemma. And he started a huge battle with Whole Foods. Now, I should tell you that in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where the show broadcasts, about a mile and a half away from here and 600 yards from our house, is the only Whole Food market for 300 miles. And it is packed from door to door. I meet Virginia, who comes all the way across town to go there, because they have clearly healthier foodstuffs than are available through conventional food outlets. But yet Michael Pollan really let loose on Whole Foods, and Whole Foods chairman and CEO replied. And I'm interested in what you think about that right after the break.
Yeah, we're going to take a break now, so see you on the other side.
You take your six-year-old to the playground. You watch her go down the slide, then run over to the swings. Another mother strikes up a conversation. You take your eye off your daughter for just a few seconds. You look back at the swings, and she's gone. Your heart drops into your stomach. You jump up, your eyes searching. You cry out her name.
Lily? Lily?
From the top of the slide, you hear a voice.
Mommy, watch me!
Every parent knows that feeling. Imagine if she were actually abducted. Go to wirelessamberalerts.org. Sign up for free Amber Alerts on your cell phone. When an Amber Alert is issued in the areas you've chosen, you'll receive a free text message. If you spot the vehicle, the suspect, or the child described in the alert, call 911. Sign up today at wirelessamberalerts.org. A child is calling for help. This message brought to you by the Wireless Foundation, the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the Ad Council.
A message for older drivers from the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety.
If you find that you have to drive at night, travel in well-lighted areas when possible.
Make sure your headlights are clean.
Keep your windshield clear, both inside and out.
Avoid driving at night in the rain or other foul weather.
Also, try to avoid busy streets or other stressful situations.
It's what makes an older driver a wiser and safer driver.
For a free brochure on older driver safety, call 1-800-993-7222.
Hi, my name's Maria, and I'm alive today because I was given CPR last year by Rick,
who took a class with the Red Cross after I received blood from Jamal, who gave blood after being encouraged by my friend Angela,
who helped Jamal's whole family get the help and support they needed after losing their home to a fire.
When we come together, we become part of something bigger than us all. By getting involved with the Red Cross, you never know how many people your actions will affect. To get involved, visit redcross.org. The American Red Cross. Together, we can save a life.
Back on the menu with the full house. We're discussing a very important issue and a wonderful book to give us insight on this the issue. It's called Food Fight by Daniel Imhoff. And we have that Daniel on the line, as well as Dan Barber, who's Chef Dan Barber of Blue Hill at Stone Barns. Is it plural, Dan?
Yeah.
Yes. And Peter, what is this? And we have also still Mindy Schwartz in the studio, Virginia Phillips in the studio,
yeah,
all
Virginia,
of us deeply interested in this issue.
And Virginia shops at Whole Food Market every week or so. I shop there almost every single day.
And what is the question that you put on the table?
There was this big uproar when Michael Pollan produced his book, and he had some uncomplimentary things to say about Whole Food Market. I think he called them industrial organic. And Whole Foods Market CEO responded with page after page after page of blog. So what do you think, guys?
Well, so, I mean, my response to that is, I mean, first of all, I'm not so sure that Michael was unfairly critical or exaggerated in his criticism. And what he basically was saying is that, look, Whole Foods is being held up to the standard that we to take another look at, and the standard was saying essentially, you know, what we're doing in terms of what we're selling is cleaner, more healthier for both you and the environment, and if you care about yourselves, your kids, your neighbors, and your environment, you should shop more at Whole Foods. That's essentially, you know, the message, and they do it. They advertise what they do in terms of telling about the kind of farmers that. And whatnot. They do it in all their stores. And so Michael took them sort of up on the challenge, and in the brilliant way that he attacks these kind of things, did some research about where their ingredients were coming from. And so this notion of organic, quote-unquote, was looked at a little bit closer, and what he found was that some of the food was traveling from very, very far distances and had attached to it some frequent flyer miles that might not make it as environmentally friendly as one would think. And so the Whole Foods organization, especially John Mackey, who takes these things incredibly personally,
right.
He built the company, gave a very long-winded response and much more than a response, sort of a defense that he viewed as an attack on his company. And basically he said, we're running a supermarket, we're giving people choices, and we've done more for the organic marketplace and for the health food marketplace than anybody else in the last 20 years. And what we're essentially doing is very, very positive. And he gave, you know, a lot of examples to support that. And, the interesting thing, and it went on with Michael writing him back and correcting him on some of his thoughts and observations, and it sort of had this back and forth that was really intriguing to read because it was a real insight into our food chain and what some of the others, or what Michael Pollan was suggesting, was that we might not want to look at organics as the answer, but that it's a whole system, including local and including small family farms and including a different distribution system that Whole Foods might want to consider in their culture. And then sort of the side note is that since that debate, Whole Foods has lost 20% on its stock price.
Really?
Yeah. And on stock price, in fact, a little bit more since Omnivore's Dilemma came out. And now that's not wholly due to Michael's comments, but it has something to do with it. And I think even more interesting is John Mackey, although he was incredibly defensive, ended up launching two huge initiatives after this debate, one of which was to devote $10 million to supporting local small family farms at each of Whole Foods' distribution centers. So they are it looked like a prickly situation that John Mackey was basically saying he didn't agree with. He ended up changing around some of the policies at great expense of the company, and the stock price has suffered in part because of it. So it was a very interesting insight into
how it all works.
But
the break, we also said, now Mindy reiterated that she believes you should vote with your fork. And I said that what I worry about is if we don't do something to stop this particular farm bill, we're going to be saddled with limited choices because if you throw in the economics of eating better food, if you're subsidizing corn and petroleum, that means that your locally grown fresh produce is costlier. And if you're poor, you get a bad lunch at school, and you can't afford to buy do you see what I mean? Where do we stop this in its tracks so that we actually do have the choice?
Not for me.
Anybody.
This is Dan Imhoff here. I think that you have to vote for those local farmers as much as you possibly can and, you know, work toward these. I would definitely not throw out organic, but just combine, you know, local and organic really as the best things that you can try to support. You have to work on your legislators, you know.
What do you ask them to do? I mean, what do you have specific points that we should be attacking in this bill?
An easy thing to ask them is to end the corporate welfare to these huge agribusinesses that are receiving the lion's share of the subsidies, and put some limits on subsidy programs that really make it a lot more equitable for family farmers. I think that's an easy thing to ask.
And do you have this specified in your book, what you can go after?
Sure. Okay. There's probably 25 different things that I kind of isolated.
Okay.
But, you know, I think in general, you can ask your legislators for a farm bill that provides healthy foods and healthy communities and healthy wildlands in our agriculture. And there are a number of bills that are floating out there right now with programs and policies and budgets to do that. I think really when you look at the overall expense of the farm bill, it averages, you know, in the $80 billion range. We probably need more money for healthy foods and healthy farms than we're actually even giving it now. And we'll find in the long run, if we have healthier people because of better nutrition and healthier water systems and healthier lands, we're going to have savings in environmental cleanup costs. We're going to find that it's actually cheaper to do it better in the first place.
Now, Dan Barber, you have a unique perspective because you're not only a well-known restaurateur and a very good one, but you're also a farmer producing for himself. So what's your take on that aspect of it?
My take on the aspect of producing food for myself,
I mean,
you know, I'm in a very fortunate position and one that I don't know that a lot of people are in the same position I am, which is that we are blessed with a restaurant that's attached to an 80-acre farm. That's an old Rockefeller estate. So the Rockefeller family gave us seed money for us to be involved with a farm that sells to our restaurants at sort of fair market value, and we're able to engage and indulge and celebrate fantastic, fresh, locally grown food and animals that are raised on the right kinds of pastures and eating the right kinds of things and whatnot. And so it ends up making me look like a much better chef than I am because the ingredients are real. And that's not a false modesty. It really is stunning, stunning ingredients that come into the kitchen. I don't do a lot with it. In fact, the more I do with it, the less good it tastes. So I tend to stay out of the way. But you know, the I think the connection between what Dan was saying and this Michael Pollan debate was to look at organic with a little bit more of a skeptical eye. That's not to say to forget organic, which is what a lot of people interpreted Michael as saying. And I think Dan hit it right on the head, is that we need to incorporate a lot of different systems into the great big food chain that we need to reinterpret. And organic is just one element of that. And Michael makes this point in this book that organic means quite a bit more than just a farming method. It's not just no pesticides and no fertilizers. It means, organic is from the root, organism. It was a whole. It was the whole thing, the whole gestalt. And so that included not just the farming method, but how far your food was traveling. And then who was growing it was very important. What kind of community, what kind of seeds did they use, what kind of biodiversity was involved in the intensity of the soil amendments. What was all of that encompassed in organic method? And what we've done in our drive to the corporatization of our food chain is to ignore those and reduce the word to a farming method. So when we can bring back a lot of other elements that include different food chains, we don't have to have just one food chain. We can have several different food
we're,
chains.
We're beginning to run out of time here. I wanted, Virginia had a couple links she wanted to mention.
Yes, I do. I think everybody should take a look at the Slow Food USA link right on the very first page, the Food and Farm Bill, What You Should Know. And another terrific one is farmandfoodproject.org. That is partly supported by the Kellogg Foundation, and it involves policy partners in the sustainable agriculture community that are highly respected and have done tons and tons of work so that ordinary people can understand this issue.
Yes.
If there ever were a time when ordinary people could and should understand it, it seems to be now. I don't know.
I think it needs to be now, and I think everyone should go on www.onthemenuradio.com and order Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill.
How much easier can we make it for you than that? Go to OTM bookshelf on the right hand side. Now, I have to put in another plug here, because Dan Barber talks about Stone Barns, but he also has a restaurant that's surrounded by many other restaurants right in the center of the urban space of the largest city in the country.
And he cooked for my birthday one year.
And yet right nearby is the huge Green Market, so that the restaurateurs can go there, but people can also go there. So in the middle of Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, is a superb farmers market that people can go to. And another great
food resources in metropolitan areas of the country. It really is a fantastic outlet. So everyone who comes to New York should visit it.
Is there another website that you'd like to put out here, Dan?
Would I like to plug a website? I mean, one of my favorites is eatwild.com. It's a little bit esoteric, but it's got some amazing links itself, and the woman Jo Robinson who put it together does some great studies about the health benefits of eating more locally and more organically. So I think that's one place to go check out.
Well, we have a lot more to talk about, but we're running out of time. The music's going to be coming up, and we're going to be out of here. Thank you, studio guests. And thank you, the two Dans, and I really hope we get moving on this food fight.
Well, thanks to Dan Imhoff, we will.
Okay.
Thanks so much
thank
for
you.
Having us.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Everybody, we'll see you same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.
Jazzin' Around with David J. is next on The Edge, AM 1550.